Have you ever had that feeling like you were not being your authentic self? Or maybe like you were pretending and everyone is going to see through the disguise? I believe my feelings stem from a series of personal disasters. Well, maybe not really disasters, but it felt like that. And now I feel guilty for labeling them disasters. It's a cycle of personal shame. I'm going to share a day in my life when my life seemed to come untethered. No one died, but my career seemed to be taken away from me. I had a position at a local hospital abruptly eliminated following a merger with another healthcare system. They already had a more senior person filling the role I had, so I was asked to leave immediately when fewer people were on my unit. I refused, locked myself in my office for about an hour. I called my husband, Mark, who also worked in the same hospital. He was shocked, and as an administrator himself, had no idea this was happening. I somehow walked on my own without a security escort to the car with two boxes. I was completely devastated, and I really had never felt so ashamed and humiliated. But for what? I really do not remember what I did when I got home. For a couple of days, I just, sat around. But then, literally, I decided I was going to find other employment. And I remembered that a local university had reached out to me a few months previously to ask if I would teach a clinical group or supervise a group of nursing students in a clinical setting. Now that my position and career plans had changed completely, I decided to approach them for a full-time position. I was educated as a registered nurse, had a master's degree, and many years of clinical experience. I was able to get an interview with the university. This was June. I learned that in order to meet minimum requirements for the position, I would need to be accepted into a PhD program by fall. Holy smokes, I didn't even know nurses with earned PhDs. And I really had no idea what I was in for. I was totally overwhelmed and felt like I was fooling everyone. Who was I to earn a PhD or work in a university? I'd been a bedside nurse or a clinical specialist my entire career, and I truly felt like an imposter. I could feel my face getting really red. Is it red? It feels really red. I remember the day my letter from the PhD program arrived, and I reluctantly opened it, and I had been accepted into this PhD program in nursing, and I was literally shocked and felt an overwhelming sense of self-doubt that I had somehow pulled the wool over the selection committee's eyes. I thought, no, they have the wrong person. These feelings did not change overnight, nor can I say that I woke with some huge revelation. It took a lot of time, a lot of support from my loving family, my friends at this fellowship. Margaret, is Margaret here? Margaret was my sounding board. and also friends from the university who had experienced their own insecurities. I did not recognize how privileged I was to have a chance to pursue a PhD and to work in a university. I was self-absorbed and frightened, and I felt like a total imposter. I slowly grew to understand that we all have important challenges and self-doubts. The keys to my success were threefold. First, to be very grateful for the privileges I have, my family, my friends, education, and a job. Secondly, to welcome the support and the love from all those people around me. And thirdly, I had to simply put one foot in front of the other and never stop. I recognize that we can all experience feeling like imposters, but we can turn to each other in this place to be heard and feel supported.
Our reading this morning comes from a lecture by Dr. Peggy McIntosh, entitled Feeling Like a Fraud. Earlier in the lecture, which is very long, she talks at length about how hard it is to feel like a fraud or an imposter and how we want to claim our worth in any situation that we're in. But in this particular part, this reading, she's talking about times when feeling like a fraud can actually be a signal, a sign of our own deep wisdom, telling us something important, that we need to be humble and sincere in our actions. She writes, "When we entertain nagging thoughts about whether we belong or deserve to be at the podium or the boardroom or tenured or giving an interview to the newspaper or earning a salary for what we like to do, we may be deeply wise in feeling anxious and illegitimate and fraudulent in these circumstances. Because," she says, "these public forums and institutions demand that we appear to be an authority figure, an expert, the best. These public forums and institutions that insist on these demands do require fraudulent behavior, and they will turn us into frauds if we accept the roles as written. The roles are dishonest, and people who are still in touch with their humanity and their frailty will properly feel fraudulent in them." So some of you have heard me share that before I went to seminary to become a minister, I was in graduate school to become a psychologist. Now let's just say that my graduate school program was less than supportive. My major professor, who was responsible for whether or not I could graduate, was psychologically abusive. It took me a really long time after leaving that program to realize that her behavior was that harmful. But I had begun to internalize her behavior into myself. She would vacillate between wild, unreasonable praise of me and my work, and then horrible criticism. She once tore up my research in a supervision meeting. Once I made the choice to leave that graduate program and pursue ministry, it took me a really long time to realize that my work was actually valuable, my presence was appreciated, and that I had something to contribute. I remember that I had a professor in seminary who was very warm, very kind. One day after class, he just kind of gently patted me on the shoulder, smiled at me, and said, "Christina, you're doing a really good job." And I knew that something was wrong inside of myself when I actually flinched away from his praise. At worst, I was sure that he was going to turn on me, like my previous professor had. But at best, I just thought he was wrong. I had fooled him. He thought I was doing a good job. Little did he know what a failure I am. Now, I did some serious therapy to unlearn these patterns of shame. Highly recommend therapy. Good stuff. Shame, though, comes at us from lots of different places. It can come at us from family. It can come at us from religion or bosses, romantic partners, or from just the world, from media, from society. I doubt that any one of us has escaped the grip of shame entirely in our lives. Shame embeds itself into our minds, into our bodies, and it whispers lies. You're not good enough. You don't deserve love. You aren't worthy of praise or good things. You don't belong here. And sometimes that shame can come out as imposter syndrome, or as Dr. Peggy McIntosh calls it, feeling like a fraud. Imposter syndrome is not a diagnosis. You're not going to find it in any doctor or psychologist's manual. It's just a common experience, a set of feelings. The fear that someone is going to figure out that you're not really as good at whatever people think you're good at, or that you don't really belong in that role or that job. I mean, I don't know about you, but people talk about adulting. It's like a common sense of fraudulence, like no matter how old you are, that you're not really an adult yet, right? Any success that you gain is an accident. It's luck. Not really due to anything that you did, because there's no way you could really be able to do that, right? Psychologists and sociologists who study human behavior note that everyone at some time in their lives can experience this feeling, but it tends to be more common in people who identify as women, people who are transgender, and people of color. This is partially because the world has whispered or yelled at these groups of people that they don't belong for generations. I think of the first women who tried to attend medical school. They were scorned by their peers, taunted publicly, or the black students who integrated public schools, white public schools, or who integrated white major league sports. They were spit on, yelled at, required to come in different entrances. Transgender folks who are denied the use of their correct names or pronouns or housing or safe bathrooms. It's not subtle. You don't belong here. Even today, in circles like Unitarian Universalist congregations, ministers of color and trans ministers have a much harder time being called to serve our largely white, trans clueless congregations. If they're called, their ministries are often shorter than white cisgender ministers. Women now make up over 55% of the UU ministry. But just this week, a colleague of mine, a woman colleague and friend, who serves a UU congregation in co-ministry with her husband, commented how often she is told how nice it is that she gets to work for her husband. And I want to show you this picture. This is from a a UU congregation in our country. These are signs that label rooms in their building, just like we have here at our fellowship. Does anyone notice anything off? If you don't know, Olympia Brown was a Universalist. She was the first woman in America ordained by a religious denomination in the 1800s. She is without a doubt a reverend, but her title was left off while the men's titles were not. This is still on the wall in a UU congregation. These subtle and not so subtle signals from our world can contribute to the feelings of imposter syndrome. Everyone can feel it. I know plenty of white men who struggle with feeling like a fraud. It can just tend to be more common with groups that are historically marginalized. So what are we supposed to do when we feel the rising concern that we don't belong or we're not good enough or we have fooled everyone? I would argue that there are two things we should do. Number one, reject that feeling. And number two, embrace that feeling. How can we do both? So here's another story from seminary that might help me explain how it's possible to do both. I was in my preaching class in my first year of seminary, and it was my turn in the rotation to speak in front of my classmates and my professor. I was standing at the little makeshift pulpit in our classroom. I was midway through my sermon. I have no memory what my sermon was about, but I remember that at some point, I prefaced a point in my sermon by saying, "I believe that." "Stop," my professor said. The professor was a 60-something white man. He had been a longtime Universalist and then Unitarian Universalist minister. He was a well-regarded writer and preacher. I loved him. I still do. "Stop," he said. So I did. "Look, Christina, unless you're quoting someone, we are assuming that what you're saying is your own original thoughts or beliefs. You don't need to say, 'I think,' or 'I believe,' because we know you believe it because you're saying it. Just say it. Don't undermine yourself." I've come to realize that these little phrases are very common, especially among women. We're socialized not to be too sure of ourselves. We apologize when apology is not in order. We backtrack before we begin. You might disagree with me, but my professor was trying to encourage me to take these phrases out of my preaching to give my preaching more weight and power. And after telling me to stop, he continued, "Cross out any time that you say I think or I believe, and then underline the thought." So when you get to that point in the sermon, instead of undermining yourself, you will get to those underlined thoughts, and then you should pound the pulpit. We laughed at that last part, because who pounds the pulpit? But he continued with something that has stayed with me for a long time. "Look, Christina, you're young, you're female, you're small. People aren't going to have any reason to trust that you know what you're talking about unless you prove it to them. They are going to take away your power unless you claim it." Oh. I mean, he's not wrong. I'm pretty much the exact opposite of what you think of when you think of powerful preacher. I've taken his words to heart. I've learned how to trust my own ministerial role, to hold my own among my colleagues. When I came to this fellowship, you might recall that I asked to be called Reverend Christina, at least publicly or in my professional capacity. Now, if you're chatting with me in coffee hour or you see me at the grocery store, no need for Reverend. But my name, if it's in print or on a sign on the wall, or if I'm being introduced, yeah, it's my title. I earned it. I've become a pretty straightforward preacher. I don't use a lot of fluff or filler. I've learned to claim my own voice. In other words, when the feelings of imposter syndrome arise, we need to reject the feeling. Now, trust me, the feelings still arise a lot. The further along that I got in my training, the worse the feelings got. I was fine until I had to go see the Ministerial Fellowship Committee. They're like this credentialing board that tells you whether or not you can pursue ordained ministry. When I passed that committee with the highest score that they give, imposter syndrome struck. Surely they gave me the wrong score. I can't possibly be ready to be a real ordained minister. And then I got hired to serve a congregation in ministry. Oh no, even more imposter syndrome. I fooled the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, but I can't fool this congregation forever. And then I entered search for a new congregation, and I got called here to this fabulous, healthy, large congregation that wanted me? Oh, crap. Surely you're all going to figure out what a fraud I am. Now I'm settling in. I'm starting to feel that these feelings are subsiding. Please do not tell me in coffee hour if you think I'm a great minister. It just makes it worse. But using techniques like the one that my professor taught me has helped me to fight against the voice that says that I don't belong. I have just as much right as anyone, as any man, to be in this pulpit. You have just as much right to pursue any goal that you have, any desire that you have any desire or ability to pursue. Don't let anyone tell you that your credentials, your background, your race, your ethnicity, your gender, your hairstyle, your size, your abilities, your quirks, or anything else about you makes you less worthy of love, praise, and inclusion. You are worthy and you are good, and that voice that says that you're a fraud is a liar. Well, sort of. That's where number two comes in. Embrace the feeling. Peggy McIntosh, in that reading that we heard before the sermon, explains, quote, "When we entertain nagging thoughts about whether that we belong or deserve to be at a podium or tenured or whatever, she says we might be deeply wise in feeling anxious and illegitimate and fraudulent in these circumstances." She says this feeling might be a signal, a deeply wise signal that something is wrong. Not with us, no, that's not what she's saying, but with the expectations of society. She goes on to say, quote, "Because these public forums and institutions tend to demand that we be an authority figure, an expert, the best, These public forums and institutions that insist on these demands do require fraudulent behavior of us, and they will turn us into frauds if we accept the roles as written. The roles, she says, are dishonest, and people who are still in touch with their humanity and with their frailty will properly feel fraudulent in them. What she's saying here is really, really powerful. She says if you feel like a fraud, it's because your own inner sense of authenticity is saying, wait, if I'm going to be me here, I'm not going to fit this role. I have to pretend to be something different, and that makes me feel like a fraud. The professor who told me not to undermine myself, to instead pound the pulpit, was giving me loving advice, but I've grown to realize he was wrong. I can claim my voice and not pound the pulpit. I can claim my voice and still be really short. I can claim my voice and wear a dress and makeup and honor my femininity. I can say, I believe, without it undermining my words, because it is what I believe, and I don't have to be 100% certain of every word out of my mouth in order for it still to be valuable. It's a sign of societal expectations that he wanted me to speak the way men are taught to speak, with certainty, without hesitation. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that way of speaking, it's just not authentic to me. If I talked like that, I would be trying to talk like someone else. Peggy McIntosh, in another part of the reading that we heard, she talks about women who were keynote speakers at a conference, and they also used similar undermining words. She says about them, quote, I suggest that when we apologize in public, we are at some level making a deeply wise refusal to carry on the pretense of deserving and feeling good about roles in conventional and oppressive hierarchies. Damn. There it is again, deeply wise. She goes on to say that things like saying, I'm sorry, means that we are actually giving other people space. We're refusing to participate in an expectation that we know everything, that we're always right, that there's no room for discussion. She says by saying, I think, or I'm sorry, but, or I could be wrong, it's possible that we're not actually undermining ourselves. It's possible that we are committing ourselves to a more egalitarian way of speaking. That we don't have to take up all the space in the room. We don't have to push aside other people's experiences in order to validate our own. When I read McIntosh's words this week in preparation for this sermon, I was blown away. I had never, ever considered that my feelings of fraudulence were anything other than something I should try to squash. She's right. Oh my God, she's right. I feel like a fraud because the expectation of me is to act one way. And if I conform to that expectation, then I'm going to be a fraud. If the woman running for president feels like a fraud, it's because she's expected to act like all the presidents before her who, surprise, were men. If the black trans professor seeking tenure feels like a fraud, it's because they're probably the first one in their department or their university to inhabit that role without the benefit of being white and cis. And damn, if they try to act like people who came before them, they will be acting like a fraud. So those feelings are spot on accurate. It has nothing to do with inherent worth or ability or strength. The feelings of fraudulence are a signal that we're trying to force ourselves into a role that goes against our deep sense of ourselves. Peggy McIntosh says the roles are dishonest, and people who are still in touch with their humanity and their frailty will properly feel fraudulent in them. Now, if we feel like a fraud, can we still accomplish our goals? Yes, absolutely. Sometimes we just have to push the feelings aside, number one, right? Sometimes we have to act in ways that don't feel 100% authentic in order to keep ourselves safe, in order to keep the job, to continue engaging with our world. Fake it till you make it, that's what they say. But we don't have to believe the feelings of fraudulence. We aren't a fraud, the role is. And this feeling can signal to us that change is still needed. We can do what Suzanne said. We can work with others who've had similar experiences. We can find mentors. We can connect to communities of people who value your worth, regardless of your status, your experience, your title, communities like this fellowship. These are all ways to claim our worth, reject the imposter feelings, and perhaps, if we can, continue to dismantle the systems that are set up for some people and not all people to be fully themselves. And I believe that that's a really beautiful goal. May it be so. Amen.